accession number 20525, reel 3.
Ken Ellis, reel 2.
Sorry, you were saying?
Where did I get to? I was explaining
We were talking about GH.
But what a fantastically, for the time, a fantastically accurate device it was. And it enabled very accurate bombing, and it was used. The group had certain squadrons equipped with this, and we used to do our own pathfinding. And there were two techniques for night bombing. We used to have the pathfinder markers and drop them, and then the rest of the group would drop on your markers. And there was none of this. Oh, sorry.
Right.
Yes, they, the rest of the force with you on that particular target would drop on your markers. And unlike pathfinders, where they had various grades of markers, for instance, there was the initial one, which was a blind marking, and then eventually, if they were wildly inaccurate, there'd be the master bomber who'd be deciding whether it was accurate enough, and if not, he put another marker down to cancel it, and then he put his a third colour for the amended bombing position. We didn't have that, you see, because our equipment was blind, and if it was effective, it was extremely accurate. They used to drop on that. And then we started daylight operations, and this was after D-Day, and we used to have a formation system whereby there'd be two wingmen from another squadron would formate on you, and when they saw your bomb doors open, they'd open theirs, and they would then wreath their bombs when they saw yours coming down, and that was very effective too.
This is still on Stirlings, was it?
No, this was Lancaster's, right. Yes. Yeah. They did have GH on Stirlings, but really that was for training up to the D-Day business. And
when did you convert onto Stirling, onto Lancaster's?
I suppose it was about August, something like that.
August 44.
It wasn't very long. I did about 10 operations on the Stirling, and then it wasn't a very quick, very long conversion. It was really just handling the aeroplane. About 6 or 8 hours flying, that's all.
Was it an easier aeroplane to fly, presumably?
Oh, yes. It was a fantastic aeroplane. It was a marvellous operational aeroplane. I can't praise it too highly. It carried a very good bomb load. It, obviously, adequate range for what we were using it for. And it had the altitude, too. You could get up high. And it was very, very good indeed. And I mean, I'm talking about the handling of it. But see, you weren't wasting your time. You weren't carrying space. You were carrying bombs. And it was very good. And the time I was doing it, you see, we'd really cracked the navigation system. I know that they were jamming. The G. But the kind of operations we were doing, I never went to the long distance ones, to Berlin or Dresden and so on, which was a totally different ball game. I was doing the Duisburg, and one flight we did was to Rüsselsheim, which was the Opel factory, but that was a disaster because when we dropped our markers, it was the extreme range, and they were really scattered, but they were disappearing into the clouds, so the following aircraft couldn't. It was a disaster, that was. But
where were you based at that time?
Well, I started off at Wolfhot's Lodge on the Stirling,
yeah.
And then I went to Methwold, and finished my operation at Methwold in Lincolnshire. Yeah. Not Lincolnshire, in Norfolkshire, Norfolk.
What about the loss ratio? Was that coming down by that time?
Oh yes, it was certainly coming down. Mm. Once we got on the Lancaster, they increased our tour to 35. When I went on the squadron, We were talking about these people who'd lost their crews through illness. We had those people too, and they were there. They were kept so that if anybody went sick, they could take their place. So we had navigators and so on. And that was a problem because I was commissioned before I went to the squadron, and I don't know, we never talked about it in the officers' mess, but the NCOs did, and they were very despondent, you know, they'd heard of the chop rate and the figures, and they came and told me these figures, and, well, what can you do about it? You just got, but it was very serious, very, very serious, the chop rate was then. But once we got on the Lancaster, well, yes, we had casualties, there's no doubt about that, but one didn't notice it very much because they had a very good system. If somebody didn't come back, they'd replace him by the afternoon, you know. They had one chap on the station whose job was to clear the room and get all the stuff away. Somebody else would come and take over. And then you had, on my squadron, we had two crews to an aircraft. And so a new crew coming on, you would shepherd them and you'd take them on their first flight. But you always took the captain on his first flight, and the crew would, you know, supervise and help the new crew. And
so you'd mix them, you'd weather them, mature them.
Well, no, only their captain
the
would,
captains, yeah.
would take on a flight. No, but on the ground, it wasn't just a matter of flying operations. There was an awful lot of ground stuff to do. I mean, for instance, the engineers, there was an engineer leader and a gunnery leader and a signals leader, and the crews used to go with them and be briefed on all the latest things and so on. And we used to go to the intelligence room. The navigator and the captain used to always go to operations. To intelligence, and we had these red manuals with all the latest stuff, all highly secret, but it paid to go and read what was happening, and so there was always something.
This was general intelligence, not specific to the target that you were.
Oh no, general, yeah. General, related to, you know, RAF intelligence. And then, of course, there was training too. I mean, we had link trainer to do, and on GH we had to practice that. And then there were drills. We were always practicing drills and so on. So there was something happening all the time, you know. And then, you see, as I said, you had two crews to an aeroplane, so one would fly it. If you had a period of continual flying, one would fly it one night, one would fly it the next night.
I never realised that. Was that general at that time?
Well, it certainly wasn't my squadron, yeah. Yes. And
because you're saying earlier that you were short of pilots and short of personnel.
Yeah.
You know, when Harris was going on maximum effort things, I would have thought every crew that was available was in the air.
Well, that was a fact, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, but as far as you couldn't operate that every night like that. If you had a period of good weather, one crew couldn't operate every night. So they had two crews. So one would operate one night, one would operate the next night. And it happened to me that, I was saying what our routine was. So during the day, we were busy. But then if you were flying, well, fair enough, you just had a bit of a rest and then you reported to intelligence and so on. But if you were the other crew, standby crew, we didn't go into the briefing, but we always went with the crew. We went out to the aeroplane with them and helped them with their drills and so on, and saw them off. And then most of us would see them back in too. And so.
Well, you always shadowed the same crew, did you?
Well, it's always the same. You had the same second crew. You had your own ground crew, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
Ground crew with the aeroplane.
The second air crew was always the same.
Always the same, yeah. Yes. And then when they finished or didn't come back, you became the senior crew. And the next crew that came, you would then shepherd them and give them all the tips and so on and see them through, help them. Yes. In fact, you never had time to think. The only time you ever, I mean, this business of going out on the town every night, it didn't happen. It happened in bad weather of particular times. Obviously, we did have our relaxation, but...
You had your own pubs to go to.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But not like it's reputed to be. I don't know whether this is... See, don't forget that Bomber Command was rather different to, say, Fighter Command. I mean, we could go out in all weathers, virtually. Although, not always, you see. And that was the thing about Stirlings. Because of the type of work that we're doing, there weren't many doing it. So if the weather was bad, obviously, Churchill wanted to say, we operated every night last month. So poor old Stirlings would be sent out, they'd take off in the fog, and wouldn't have a clue where they were going to land when they came back. And they'd go out, way down to Lorient or somewhere in the Kattegat or somewhere, and they come back and we were told to keep radio silence till we're over the UK. And then they would tell us where to go. We had no idea where we were going. I mean, I've landed at Lynham, I've landed down at, what's that Air Force station near Biddeford, Barnstable?
Oh, Chivna.
Chivna, yes. I landed at Chivna and, you know, you never had a clue, didn't have a clue where you were going to land. Or the other one was the place where you landed if your undercarriage was shot up and so on. There were two, weren't there? There was one in...
Wittering was one, was it? We had a long runway there.
Yes, it probably was Wittering.
Or and Manston.
Manston was, yes, Manston, or there was one near Ipswich. God, my brain's going these days. No, it was right on the coast, and it had Fido, and... He'd had bulldozers to bulldoze the airplanes off the runway and so on.
The Americans but, used it later on, didn't they?
Yeah, but that was the thing on the Stirlings. You hadn't a clue where you were going to land.
You were mentioning earlier on that because they couldn't get to an altitude, they often suffered casualties from the bombs.
Oh, yes. We had a chap who came back with a bomb on the... There was always a crew bunk for casualties. And one chap came back with a 250-pound bomb on the crew bunk. Fortunately, the winder hadn't wound off, so it wasn't live. And then there was the radio operator who had his leg chopped off and bled to death. It was a pretty gory story. From a bomb coming through, yes. Oh, yes, some pretty nasty things. And, of course, the aircraft would just be knocked out of the sky, wouldn't it? In some cases, bomb wasn't always pointing straight down, and if it hit the wing, and of course the aircraft just didn't come back. You know, it's just a casualty, but they realised that's what was happening, and the casualties on the Stirlings towards the end were pretty high, much higher than the Lancs. Lancs was a marvellous aeroplane.
You were saying earlier on that, that by the time you went on operational flying, you had an awful lot of experience written into your logbook.
Yeah, the handling, yes.
Helped your survival chances.
Oh, very much so, yes, very much so. It meant that when I was doing my conversion onto the aeroplanes, it was easy, you know. I was just learning the technical stuff and the handling. But as far as air craftsmanship, you know, was concerned, I didn't have to think about it. It was a great asset, really.
Because one read of youngsters coming onto Lancaster with about 100 hours in their logbooks.
Probably, yes.
And, you know, really making...
I don't know about Lancasters, but certainly it happened with the Wellingtons, yes. In fact, there was a scheme to put people straight on Wellingtons, put them on Tiger Moths, and then transfer them straight onto Wellingtons, which was a disaster. But it meant that people were on operations with about 150 hours. Mm. And I was very lucky. You see, because I was commissioned before I went to OTU. I was a flight sergeant then. I went to OTU as a flight sergeant. And OTU is where you crewed up. You see, and I got my well-worn... battle dress and so on, and my sergeant's stripes were really very ragged, and my wings were all worn with a parachute harness over it. And So this crew, it was the remnant of a crew which had literally that, their pilot had done his, got hopped straight from Tiger Moths onto Wellingtons, and they were an operational crew with about, by the time they had about 150 hours, and they were ferrying this aircraft to Wellington out to the Middle East, and they were going down to Jib, and they were shot down in the sea just off Lisbon, and they were picked up very rapidly, but unfortunately one of the crew was killed then, and they were interned by the Portuguesos, but the Portuguesos of course are our old allies, so it was all a formality. They were shipped off to a place up country, and the next thing they were in civilians, and they were on board a flying boat being flown back to England, and this flying boat crashed just outside Shannon. So they were, the crew was very reduced, injuries and so on. So I inherited the rear gunner and the bomb aimer. And they picked up me because of my worn uniform, you see. And then they, the navigator, he was the top of his course, and anyway, for some reason, I got him. I got the navigator. My radio operator also was a very, very good navigator, who was chosen by the rest of the crew. So my crew was more or less chosen for me. And they were all, very, not all of them, that lot were very, very good. And then I had a green engineer, and I had a green mid-upper gunner. But basically, I had a very good experienced crew. I had a marvellous navigator. Marvellous. I think that's why eventually we were posted on to 218 Squadron, because we worked very well together as a team. We worked together very well as a crew. And
I suppose your worn battle dress was a reassuring sight for new crew members.
Well, that's right. That's why they picked me out, you see, because I had this worn, very well worn. The only other one who was an ex-staff pilot was a flight lieutenant, and he picked up Sessai, who was in civilian life, he was an accountant, but he was the next top in the course. And my navigator should have got a commission, but he was a Scotsman from Edinburgh, and his father was a butcher, and he was very anti-establishment and so on, and the last thing he wanted for it was a commission. So Sessai got it, you see. And
Sessai, that was his name, was it?
Yes, this was the officer, yeah. Navigator. And I know, yes, I remember now. I was talking to the other staff pilot, and he'd already chosen him as the navigator, and he said, you want to have Jock as your navigator. He was the top of the course, and he's very good, very good. He was an insurance man, and he's a very good brain. So anyway, suffice it to say, I think that's why we went on a GH squadron, because he was really hot top a notch. And I say, you know, all I say myself, I was very lucky with my crew, very, very lucky. It helps an awful lot, doesn't it, you know, if you've got a good crew. And there we are.
Yeah. Can you tell me a bit more about your Wellington flight trials with all this electronic stuff?
Oh yeah, well, when I finished operations, I was supposed to be going on a blind landing, to be taught blind landing instruction, conversion onto this blind landing system. But they had technical faults with it, so right at the last minute the posting was cancelled. So I got this 1 to 60 group, which was the radar group in charge of all the radar stations all the way around, and it was just packed to the gunwales with boffins. And certainly not Air Force types, they were all, you know, very civilian type people. Although my boss was Wing Commander Fennessy, who rapidly became a group captain. And yet we were on the same level, you see, and I was just the driver airframe, really. And we had a fully operational Wellington, a brand new one, and I lost my rear gunner and I lost my bomb aimer. They both went off and they were commissioned, and They did quite well. One stayed in the Air Force and ended up as a group captain. The other one went back to the, he was a bloodsucker, income tax. But he went back to that. But so I had an operational crew, and I had an operational Wellington with operational guns down the back and so on. And the idea was that they were having trouble with this, with the G and so on, and the scientists wanted to go out with the main force and work it all out, find out what the problem was. So that was it, really, why we went. And I was very lucky because I was treated as as operational crew, and I got my regular leave and operational petrol, so it was really was a nice little number.
Operational petrol?
Oh, yes.
Or fuel
car? Oh, yes. If you, if you were operational crew, you had special duty petrol for when you were on leave, which was an excuse, wasn't it? It was enough to get you on leave and back. But it also it meant that, I mean, I had a friend who had he was a corn merchant, farmer and a corn merchant, so he had his own petrol pump, so I could get plenty of petrol when I was at home anyway. But it was whenever you stopped, it was an excuse, you were operational air crew, and they never bothered, you see. Whereas everybody else had a very limited petrol allowance and obviously didn't use it very much for social life. Oh, yes.
I thought you all had to go on trains when you went on leave.
Oh, no, 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 not on operations, no, no. That was a great asset, that was. And this unit was based Leighton Buzzard, and so I went back to Wing, which was the airfield just outside Leighton Buzzard, and of course they were ex-flight operational crew instructing, and of course the envy that I had operational petrol, and they wanted to know what I was doing, what kind of, I said, I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to say, it's, you know. So it was all highly amusing. But anyway, fortunately, we didn't do much of that sort of thing. And it ended up of course, the big thing was to open up the radar stations out to the Middle East, ready to go out there.
Well, calibrating them and so on, was it?
Well, initially it was. Well, when they had a problem, they went up and they, in a sense, I suppose you might call it calibrating, but they were investigating what the problems were.
Yeah.
And also they were. They had to have certain basic information in order to work out the lattice charts. That's what they call them, lattice charts, G-lattice. Yes. And so anything like that, they sorted out. And they were all, you know, MAs and MSCs and so on. Holstead, who came with me regularly, he was MSC. And very, very... I just remember him. He looked a bit owlish. You know, he was quite unworldly. I mean, I suppose we were pretty rough, weren't we, air crew? I mean, we were, you know. And but they were still in academe, really. And nice people. And when we were on the squadron, you see, all the work was done by long-haired. Academic types. So we had these people who came to the station to work out the coordinates for dropping the bombs and so on, which was part of the navigator's briefing, and it was very interesting, really. Mm. Yes, that was I found that side of it very interesting too. We had our own radar department, which set up the sets according to the scientists' requirements. So it was a bit of a doddle, really. I enjoyed it very much. And of course that's what led me, as I told you earlier, that's what led me to civil flying. When old Fennessy told me that he'd got his post-war job organised, I thought, well, it's time for me to do it. And so when I saw the Air Ministry orders, BAC wanted pilots, two expired pilots, I was there, and within 6 weeks I was in BAC.
Move out of the services. Just going back to, say, flying a Stirling or a Lancaster, was your liaison with the flight engineer absolutely vital, or could you have done without him?
Oh, well, on the Stirling, you could not have done without him at all.
Mm.
And anyway, the training we had was only the base, very minimum of engineering training. We depended on the engineer very much. Every member of the crew was vitally important. And that's why the crew worked together very, very well. It was vitally important. In the Stirling, all the cocks and switchery for the engineers were down the back. They were about probably 8 feet away from the pilot, and you communicated by intercommunication.
Whereas in the Lancaster, the engineer was right next to you.
Oh, yes, he sat right next to you, yes. Yeah. Yes, much better thing. The only trouble was my engineer kept on flashing. Of course, he had to take engine readings all the time, and he kept on flashing his torch in my eyes. And, of course, it's essential to have good night vision, and, of course, it's destroyed. Yeah. We got around that one. I mean, the first thing, when you took a new aeroplane, the first thing you'd do was to get chewing. We always issue with chewing gum, you see. So it was to get the chewing gum and put it over the warning lights, and then just scratch a tiny little hole in the middle so there was only the vaguest sign of it. Because, I mean, obviously, we were night bombers, basically. And it's very important to keep your night vision. Very important.
What other wrinkles did you have in flying these aircraft? I mean, making them a convenient work tool, if you like. Sorting out manufacturers' problems that perhaps, the manufacturers haven't put into them.
I really can't remember at this stage. I can't remember anything particular. I mean, like everything else, you get used to things. If things were not really absolutely, for instance, the Stirling, it was a damn nuisance having this really great
handbrake
lever, but you got used to it. And the wheel on the Stirling was enormous. It was a thin control wheel was enormous. Yes, and you just
like
accept
it.
I suppose it was probably the same. Probably exactly the same. The same with the actuators for the throttles. And I can't remember what the device was called. I've got the book outside, actually, the Stirling book. But you had to prime the hydraulics so that the first thing you do, there was the throttle lever, and on the top was a little extension. And you had to move this extension over to bleed and prime the lines and so on. It was a very efficient system when it worked, very positive. Oh, there were an awful lot of good things about the Stirling, but the trouble was it was expensive. See, it didn't take the bomb load. I mean, the bank took the £4,000 cookie, no problem at all. I mean, the bomb load on the Lank, you could either have all 250s or all 500s, but the Stirling, so you had £500, you see. But the Lank, you had these great panniers of the incendiary bombs, and then you had the smaller bombs, which were mostly delayed action bombs, and they had the big cookie, which was primed to explode before it hit the ground. So that would explode and shatter the buildings, and then down would come the incendiaries. They would set the buildings on fire, and the unexploded bombs would upset the fire crews and so on. And, I mean, I hate it, really.
Going back to what you were saying, I mean, it's something I've experienced. You know, when I didn't do anything more than private flying, but when I learned to fly, to begin with, everything is done by the book. You know, you've got a ritual, all your checks, and you have to think through, and you have to think about flying. But after a certain number of hours, I found that all that instruction was part of me.
Yes.
And the aeroplane was almost part of me. I mean, presumably this is what you found once all your hours of experience had built up.
Oh, yes, actually handling the aeroplane,
it was just an extension of yourself.
Yeah, and also you'd made all your mistakes on simple aeroplanes, and you didn't have to experiment the same way. I mean, I remember some of the chaps who'd just come out of training school on the Lanks were going around beating things up and doing all kinds of ridiculous things, coming back from a raid and coming low over the airfield and pulling away. I wouldn't do that. I mean, number one, I realised that if you'd had any flak damage, you know, something might happen. Anyway, I didn't need to do it. I was quite happy just flying the aeroplane. It was a tremendous advantage to have had that experience behind me.